Welcome to the 7 Series with Greg Davidson, where we tap the biblical number of perfection in creative ways to explore faith, science, and culture. All right, to repeat the podcast intro line, we tap into the biblical number of perfection in creative ways to explore faith, science, and culture. The first 10 episodes stuck mostly to topics of faith, with a focus on the creation story, largely drawing from the book, The Manifold Beauty of Genesis 1, that was co-authored with Ken Turner. From there, we drifted into the realm of science, where in the last two episodes, we explored questions of whether modern science is inherently in conflict with the Bible. No case was made for the validity of any scientific subject, only pointing out reasons why there is far less conflict than typically assumed. Modern science and the Bible, properly understood, are not in conflict. But what about the accuracy or the truthfulness of scientific claims? That's the subject of the next two episodes, with today focusing on the evidence for the history of the planet in terms of an age that goes back billions of years, and then the next focusing on what the evidence is for evolutionary development of life. After that, we will start to get into some cultural topics to see if we can shed some light into some often murky waters. But for today, in this episode, I am joined by my friend, co-author, co-worker in ministry, and fellow geologist, Ken Wolgamuth. Ken, welcome to this episode.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's good to be with you again.
Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into talking about some of these things.
I grew up in a Christian home as a child, and my dad was a chemistry professor at a Christian university, so that I basically knew that God was my creator ever since I was a child. And all things we studied about of any of the sciences, it was learning what God had done in the past, and as he is active in the present. He is the creator and sustainer of the universe. So I got involved with chemistry because my dad was a chemistry prof, and I enjoyed that subject, which eventually led me to Wheaton College to graduate with a chemistry major. And there, the department chairman had guided me to get into the topic of geochemistry, and ended up being able to go to Columbia University and carrying out a project on ocean water chemistry. So that has been my world in sort of coming up in my faith position and getting into this profession of geology and geochemistry. About 10 years ago, I became involved particularly with the faith and science community when we had an event here in Tulsa that gave me signals that I should get involved personally sharing what I had found out about God's creation.
I think that might actually be closer to 15 years ago now, Ken.
As soon as I said 10, it's actually 20.
Yeah, more like 20. So
No.
That's good. We're going to keep that. It was shortly after that that you and I actually met at a conference and just, I think, went out for dinner and started chatting and realized that we were sharing a similar calling, being able to speak truth into the church regarding scientific evidence from a perspective of honoring the truthfulness of Scripture. So what we're going to do for this episode, addressing the subject of the age of the earth, we're going to look at four myths or four misconceptions of science, whether it is how science works or assumptions that are supposedly made, and use those in order to communicate what the evidence actually is for the history of the earth. So the first one, myth one, is a common claim about two different kinds of science. One that is described as legitimate science and the other one, shall we say, somewhat questionable. So Ken, what do we often hear, how those are defined?
One, there is operational science, and the other that is mentioned frequently is historical science. in that segment of the church that talks about the differences between these two. Identify operational science is that which we can take to the laboratory, or we can test something and get some results and do something with it. So testing the nature of medical type of issues, or say mechanical properties of materials to be able to do construction work, or all those kinds of things, that's operational science to do in the lab at the present time. In sharp contrast, the identification of historical science is just taking a presuppositional view that things happened in the past, but there's no mechanism trying to decide what has actually come to be, because anything looking at the past is made up of a lot of assumptions that cannot be tested. One of the refrains is they ask if, were you there when that happened? Well, of course not. I wasn't there when the Civil War happened. I wasn't there when the Revolutionary War happened, but I can read the records and I can find out what happened and how that influences me today. So historical science is kind of poo-pooed as not being credible in terms of a scientific inquiry.
Yeah, and just to make sure everybody understands, individuals we're talking about, mostly coming out of young Earth organizations, they don't discount history, right? They would say, in terms of the Civil War or the Revolutionary War, that we, even though we weren't there, there were people there that saw it. There were eyewitness accounts, and we can read those, and that's why we know those, that history. But if we go back to a time before there were human beings, whether, you know, that's before Adam and Eve or before humans started writing things down, then there were no eyewitnesses. And so without those eyewitness accounts, we just really don't know what happened, and all we're doing is speculating. So historical science is just based on a presupposed philosophical point of view that's not even real science. So between us, Ken, I think we've got like 70 or 80, I don't know, 80 years of experience in the sciences. And yeah. that actually doesn't sound like anything that we've lived in any one of those decades.
I chalk up actually that I can say 60, honestly.
Oh, just on your own?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that means, oh, good grief, Ken. That means like,
yeah,
the two of us were pushing near a century. What I will describe to my students is that if we're going to divide up science into categories, I will refer to three different kinds, all of which are legitimate science. The one that's the most familiar to people would be the experimental science. That's the one where you can form hypotheses that you can test under controlled conditions. So those would include things like what happens in a chemistry lab. Like, you come up with what you think is going to happen, you test it, you see if that's what actually happens, and you can come up with new molecules, new chemicals, new pharmaceuticals, the kind of science that you learn about with the scientific method. Another is observational science, where we're not necessarily forming hypotheses. We're simply observing nature to document behaviors, patterns, and relationships. So just as an example, maybe we go out to a desert where there are dunes, and we sit there and we watch, and we see the wind blowing, and we see that the grains of sand are traveling along the surface of the dune, and they travel up a gentle slope, and then they fall off and deposit on a steep slope. Well, just based on that observation, which typically we're going to repeat, like we don't just make one observation and move on, based on that kind of observation and seeing how nature works, if I go to a dune when no wind's blowing, based on the shape of that dune, I can still confidently say I know the direction that that dune has been moving. So that's observational science. The third is forensic science. This would be applying experimental and observational science to determine what happened in the unobserved past. Now, that's what might be called historical science, but when historical science is described as if it's something that's just kind of guesswork, or what would you like the history to have been? Just think about all of the crime scene investigation shows that are on like practically every night on TV, where the job of forensic investigators is to go to a crime scene where either there were no witnesses or, you know, whoever, if anybody saw it, they're not talking, and be able to piece together a sequence of events and individuals involved with enough confidence to get a jury conviction. That is very much a science. When we are applying forensic science to Earth history, we have two kinds of, or two approaches to what we call dating. Ken, what are those?
Well, the first one, the two of them specifically are relative dating and absolute dating. And I always like and get a kick out of the way Greg handles this in all the meetings, in that relative dating is not taking your cousin to a movie, which always gets a chuckle. So in relative dating, we're watching the things of that patterns that are happening, say, in nature. So a dominant one, say, for geology is looking at the way the sedimentary layers are laid down on top of each other, in that the oldest are on the bottom, generically, and the youngest are on top. But there are times that some event may happen, as a volcanic event occurs and something intrudes into that stack of sedimentary rocks, and we can observe the patterns of the relationships and make conclusions about what is the sequence of events that has happened in this particular outcrop. And I love the example that we put into the Grand Canyon book. Greg prepared a series of tracks in sand, a car that went across the sand. There was evidence of a bicycle. There was evidence of a somebody walking. And by the relationship, interrelationship and overlapping relationships of these different ones, we could determine in what the sequence of events happened that were imprinted into that sand.
So relative dating is actually not determining ages at all. It's actually just determining a sequence of events. So going back to like the crime scene, if the maid that was driving the car and the butler that was riding a bike and, you know, the nephew that was walking, we can look at those prints and see if any of them overlap. If the bike track is on top of the car tracks, we know that whoever rode the bike left after the person driving the car. And if there's a footprint or a shoe print that's on top of the bicycle track, even if it's not on top of the car track, we know that that person was the third to leave. So a sequence of events can be put together where we don't necessarily know exactly when those happened, but we can at least determine the order of events. So the same principle is put to work in the geosciences, where if we are looking at an outcrop and we've got rock that has been folded or rock that has been faulted, or as Ken said, that you've got a igneous intrusion that's moved into cracks, well, you can't fold rock that isn't there already, right? You had to have the rock there first, then the folding. If there was an erosion, you can't erode something that's not there. So that layers have to be there to be eroded. If there's a fault, if there's a break in the rock, it can't break something that's not already there. The rock had to be there to be broken. So applying some of that logic, we can begin to piece together a sequence of events where we could say, this is time one, this is time two, this is time three, this is time four. But of course, in the geosciences, that doesn't sound very sexy. So if you go back a couple hundred years, and when they were starting to put together all of this, rather than calling them time one, time two, time three, they gave them names. So it'd be like the Jurassic period or the Cretaceous period. So at the time, nobody knew how old those were. All they knew was that there was a particular order to the Earth's layers, which incidentally, when you look at the young Earth literature, they don't disagree with that order. Actually, in large part, will agree with the general order that one finds in the geologic column, where forensic science was applied to determine that sequence. They just disagree about when it happened and how it happened. we're going to dive in a little bit deeper here on the relative dating, where we're going to look at an example in the Grand Canyon to consider myth number two. Myth number two, we hear this a lot from the Young Earth organizations, that the geologic column, and especially deep time, was invented based on an assumption of evolution. In other words, the only reason that a lot of time is argued is to give time for evolution to happen. Now, that's kind of interesting because the geologic column was largely fleshed out before Darwin's Origins of Species was published, before there was widespread acceptance of evolutionary theory. And many of the scientists that were responsible for putting together the geologic column were actually professing Christians, who often were dedicated to the truth of Scripture as well as to the investigation of Earth history. What we want to do is, without trying to make a case for a particular length of time, we're going to look at the Grand Canyon and start down at the river and just kind of walk through what one sees as you start walking up towards the rim to get an idea of whether this, you know, could all have happened just in a short amount of time or whether it might have taken a little bit longer. We're going to be kind of reading off a list here and maybe elaborating a list a little bit as we go. So Ken, start us off with what we find down at the Colorado River.
Right at the river, we're in what is referred to as the inner gorge. And in the inner gorge, there are rocks that are massive crystalline rocks that have minerals that have the evidence of being heated intensely. We have fractures that are filled, now are granite. There's tended to be widespread erosion that has indicated periods of uplift and exposure to water and wind, behavior of erosion. There are sedimentary layers that appear on one erosional surface that are consistent with rising and falling of the seas during the time window when these were deposited, including limestone rocks. Those are chemical precipitation from seawater. It's not a transport particles process like moving sand or silt and mud.
On top of those chemical precipitates, calcium carbonates, we've got mud layers. We've got magma that we find that has been intruded up through those layers and also flowed out over the surface. On top of that, we've got evidence of more erosion. So that implies that it was uplifted, exposed to the surface. On top of that, we have iron-rich sand and silt layers. You go up through several of those layers. On the top of that, we start to see, or we see evidence of more erosion again. On top of that erosional surface, we see alternating layers of mud, of sand, and back to some of those chemical precipitates, calcium carbonate, with also evidence of some alteration where you get magnesium that's swapping out for some of the calcium. And we start to see layers that are rich in microfossils, where we didn't see any of those below. But many of these layers now have these microfossils, these single-celled organisms that will grow into these colonies that are called stromatolites, very recognizable. Start to see those in some of these layers. Above that, there's a conglomerate layer, which is a mixture of coarse and fine-grained particles, where you can have cobble-sized particles that are included. And if we look just at that sequence, which that was a super abbreviated sequence, right? Within each one of those, there's finer gradations. But just looking at that sequence, which you might be surprised, is over 2 miles thick. 2 miles thick. And there's no fossil life in that 2 miles of thickness other than those single-celled organisms. And it all turned to rock. That entire system was then exposed back at the surface, where we have some interesting things going on. Ken, what do we see in those layers?
That whole sequence of sedimentary rocks were uplifted, and then they were tilted. So now they're no longer flat. they're dipping down at an angle of something like 10 to 20 to 30 degrees. There's faulting that has happened all through there. There were blocks that were sliding past each other, and there was widespread erosion leveling off of a surface that has become referred to as the Great Unconformity.
I'll point out that often a big deal is made out of that Great Unconformity as being, you know, a very unusual, very widespread, huge erosional event. But you have the same thing at the bottom of those crystalline rocks. So before you had sediments beginning to form on top of those crystalline rocks was another very large, widespread erosional event. So it's happened more than once. All right, that just gets us up to the first horizontal layers within the canyon. Starting to hike up towards the rim, we're seeing more deposition consistent, again, with rising and falling seas, where we get sand layers, we get mud layers, then more limestone, so that's the chemical precipitate again. Then we see erosion of that surface where we even have river channels, some of them as much as 400 feet deep, that are preserved in that surface. And if you look at the river channels, you can actually map out an ancient river system, a river network that was in that layer. On top of that, we then have these massive limestone beds that are made up of hundreds of feet of one community after another of crinoids, marine bottom-dwelling organisms. On top of that, we've got another erosional surface with more river channels preserved. These are kind of interesting because if you look at the what's filling the bottom of those river channels, you have terrestrial fossils in the bottom that then transition to marine fossils in the top of those river channels. Within the underlying limestone, we have caves that developed, so these voids. And then as you've got this deposition that's occurring on top of that, those caves get filled with sediment from the overlying layers. Ken, pick up from there. What do you find above those?
Well, as this keep on going, there are channels that are eroded, some of a little further up in the section of 80 feet deep. Then a rock that's called a conglomerate that is made up of larger pebbles and smaller pebbles together with sand, with animal tracks through some of those, of some of the animals that were there. Continued with more erosion and channels up to 35 feet thick. So the point is multiple locations up and down through the canyon where there is evidence of erosion. Then a phase of massive sand dunes that looked very much like sand dunes that you would see out in the desert. On top of that, some gypsum beds, which is indicative of some evaporation that took place at some point so that it wasn't lake water or water-moving material. More mud and more sand layers. And so this cycle repeats multiple times coming up through the canyon.
All that brings us up to the rim of the Grand Canyon. From the rim down to what we referred to as the Great Unconformity, all of that falls into the Paleozoic era. If we head away from the rim, we start to go up what's called the Grand Staircase, where we get into layers that are part of the Mesozoic and then eventually the Cenozoic era. Well, in the Grand Canyon layers, Paleozoic, the young Earth community would argue that that's all from the first half of a one-year flood. Well, if that was the case, you know, we have an idea of what to expect from massive tsunamis, because we've seen large tsunamis in places like Japan, where you get marine and terrestrial debris that are all cast up on the shore, all mixed together. So if we look in the Grand Canyon layers for evidence of this kind of mixing of all kinds of organisms, it's rather interesting that we find no real mixing, that we'll find some layers that have terrestrial fossils, we'll find layers that have marine fossils that are on top or underneath, but not mixed together. And in all of that sequence, we don't find a single fossilized crab, marine reptile, dinosaur, pterodactyl or bird, mammal, not even a bony fish, like the kind of fish that we see today, and not even flowering plants. In fact, we don't even see pollen of flowering plants. Now, if you've ever seen in the spring when you have like that pollen gets released from plants or trees or shrubs and it gets lofted in the wind, it can travel miles. We don't see a single grain of pollen from a flowering plant anywhere in the Grand Canyon layers, and not even grass, right? You think grass is everywhere. We don't see any evidence of grass fossils or grass seed anywhere in the entire canyon. As you move up out of the Paleozoic rocks into the Grand Staircase, we see thousands upon thousands of layers that have a similar appearance to the Grand Canyon in the sense of being alternating layers of mud, silt, sand, conglomerate, limestones, evaporites, lava flows, where the only real difference between the Paleozoic layers in the canyon and the Mesozoic and Cenozoic layers as you get out of the canyon is the type of life that is preserved. All right, so hopefully you get a sense that what we see just in the canyon alone requires a lot of time. Now, whether that means thousands of years or hundreds of thousands or millions, right, that could be open for some discussion. But if we want to find out what the actual age in years is, then we're going to have to come up with another method besides just relative dating, right? We're not just looking for a sequence of events. We actually want to be able to say that layer is this many years old. So that brings us to absolute dating. Ken, just to give us a brief description of the kinds of things that we may, or kinds of methods that we may use in order to determine a calendar date for a specimen or a sample.
Sure, glad to. There are about four or five different types of things that are in biology and geology that we can count. The easiest to think about is the cross-section of a tree. So tree rings come and grow primarily one ring per year. So when you see a cross-section of a tree, the number of rings can be counted, and so you have an idea of how old that tree is. Another type of counting that can be taken is that the way corals grow have sometimes stamps in them in terms of the nature of the way the growth of the coral is as it's living in some kind of a coral reef. The one that I always find it's the easiest to comprehend is considering ice cores, such as the ice cores that were drilled in the Greenland ice sheet from the surface down 2 miles to bedrock, because the snowfall falls in the wintertime. And without the snowfall in the summertime, any dust that has come in there over that ice sheet leaves a bit of a darker layer. So the counting of layering, light and dark layering in the ice cores are a way of counting in absolute age in terms of number of years.
Yeah, so we're intentionally holding off on radioactive dating for a bit here, because this is going to take us to myth three, where criticisms are made of these counting techniques, where myth three, or misconception three, is that counting these layers, you know, whether it's tree rings or corals or lake sediments or ice layers or stalactites and stalagmites, that they all depend on untestable assumptions of things like one tree ring per year, when scientists know that there are ways that you can get more than one ring in a year, or maybe not get any ring in a given year. So we're just making these assumptions that there wasn't some dramatic things going on in the past where we had a large number of rings that may have formed in a single year. So these counting methods can't really be trusted. So what we're going to do to address this is we're going to combine three different methods to show how we actually test these assumptions, right? That we're actually not just assuming that trees put on one ring a year, or that We have these lake sediments that just form these fine layers, one per year, that can be counted. But we have ways of testing that. We're going to do that by combining tree rings, lake layers called barves, and carbon-14. So we'll explain a little bit more of those. So everybody's pretty familiar with tree rings, like Ken just described, that typically puts on a light and a dark ring each year, so they're pretty easy to count. And in some environments, we'll have lakes that will put or create very distinct annual layers. In some northern climates, it may be coarse grains in the spring when the stream flows are high, and then fine grain during the winter when lakes are frozen over. Or we have some places where you'll get annual spring algal blooms. And as those die and settle out, it forms these very distinct patterns of light and dark, where each one is known as a varve. All right, so the young Earth community will argue that, as we just mentioned, that there's known processes that could result in more or less than a ring in a tree per year, more or less than one sediment layer in a year, and we're just making these assumptions. So what we're going to do is think about carbon-14. Ken, just tell us briefly how carbon-14 appears in the air and ends up in critters and lake sediments.
Well, as you know, in the atmosphere, we have nitrogen, and cosmic rays that are coming directly from the sun, or cosmic rays that come just in from space, have enough energy that they impact nitrogen atoms, the nitrogen-14 atom, and it gets converted to carbon-14 atom. So this is basically happening in the nucleus to change the nitrogen atom to a carbon atom. That carbon-14 then gets connected to oxygen and carbon dioxide. A portion of carbon dioxide then in the atmosphere is taken up by the trees during photosynthesis, and the carbon-14 gets into the rings of the trees, and anything that is growing and using carbon dioxide, it's getting into those. And then when animals are eating the grass, the animals also, and we have a burden of carbon-14 in our bodies because this is happening on a continual basis.
Wait, you're saying I have carbon-14 in my body right now?
Yes, I do.
And you're saying I'm radioactive?
Yeah, we're somewhat radioactive. We have a little bit. Thankfully, it's only a trace and it's not dangerous.
So what you heard was that carbon-14 is being produced continuously in the atmosphere. It's not building up because as soon as it forms, carbon-14 is also decaying. So we end up with a more or less steady state where we've got carbon-14 being created, carbon-14 is decaying away, and we can get fluctuations in the amount that's produced because you have something as simple as a solar flare, you've got more cosmic rays coming in, you're going to produce more carbon-14. So the amount that's produced in the atmosphere can and has varied to some degree over time, but we have ways of accounting for that. Plants take up carbon-14 from the atmosphere, from that CO2. Same thing. They are continuously taking in new carbon-14, but it's also decaying. So there's kind of this steady state of new carbon-14 coming in and losses of carbon-14 as that decays. But once they die, then the input is cut off. So now it's just decaying. So the more years that pass, the less and less and less and less of that carbon-14 remains. Well, in a tree, the newest ring is taking that atmospheric C14, adding it to that ring. As soon as it moves to the next year and the next ring, that previous ring, there's no new carbon-14 being added. So as you go backwards in time through those rings, you're seeing less and less and less carbon-14. Well, turns out we see the same thing in sediments. Because if you go to a place where I mentioned algal blooms, those algal blooms were taking up atmospheric CO2 with that carbon-14 in it. When they die and settle out at the bottom, no new C14 is being added. So as you go down in those layers to each older layer, the carbon 14 content is decreasing. Now, for this example, we don't need to know how much was produced in the atmosphere at any given time. We don't need to know how variable it is. For this example, we don't even need to know what the decay rate is or if it's constant. All we are going to look at is to say, hey, if a tree put on a ring in the same year that a sediment layer formed, then they took in the same amount of atmospheric C14. And so as time goes by and C14 is decaying, they're going to decay at the same rate and they're going to maintain the same C14 as each other. So if I take a tree ring and I take a sediment core and I look for a ring on the tree and a layer in the sediment core that have the same carbon 14 content, I may not know exactly how old those are, but I at least know they're the same age. All right, so they have the same amount of carbon 14 in them today. They must have grown and deposited in the same year. Well, now I can apply a test, because if the tree rings all put on one ring per year and the sediment layers all put on one new layer a year, as I start going back in time on the tree core or in the sediment core, each layer should have the same amount of carbon 14. If they varied significantly, you know, a bunch of tree rings when there was just one sediment, or a bunch of sediment layers when there was one tree ring, the C14 content's not going to match. It's going to diverge as I start moving down through the tree core, through the sediment layer. We now have extended tree core records, extended sediment layer records, places like Lake Suigetsu in Japan, where they have done exactly that, where you can compare a large sequence of the tree rings to a large sequence of the sediment layers. And the C14 content matches. The only way that is logically possible is if in each one of those environments, one layer was deposited in a year, one tree ring grew in a year, and we can trust the accuracy of those counting methods. No assumptions necessary. All right, we're going to leave that one.
What I appreciated about that so much is that we are blessed with 4,000 years of tree rings with that kind of data, and it overlaps with sedimentary bars from Lake Suigetsu from the time window of 10,000 years ago to 14,000 years ago, and they match each other remarkably.
Oh, yeah, and we didn't mention that Lake Suigetsu, there's something like 100,000 layers, and in other places in the sedimentary record, we find some places with hundreds of thousands of these layers, each indicating the passage of a year. All right, with that, we are going to move to the final myth, which is going to address radioactive dating, where this myth or this misconception is that radiometric dating is also based on a set of assumptions that can't be tested. What kind of assumptions are we supposedly making, Ken?
Well, there are two or three items mentioned in particular. The claim is made that we cannot possibly know how much of the daughter product is in this particular rock at the beginning, that there is no leakage of either the parent or the daughter out of the particular kind of rock where these isotopes are found. And then the claims that is radioactive decay a constant into the past is questioned.
Yeah, and actually they go even farther than just saying that we don't know if the decay rates have always been the same, to argue that decay rates were actually faster in the past, which, especially during the flood, which is why things look so old today. It looks like a whole lot of time has passed for all this radioactive decay to take place, when in fact, they argue that radioactive decay rates were just a lot faster in the past. I'm going to make a kind of a philosophical observation before we address the, you know, how we go about testing these assumptions. And that's making note of the fine-tuning argument. So the fine-tuning argument is a philosophical argument for the existence of God that many people have noted that there are a large number of physical constants that include things like the force of gravity and the speed of light and the strong and the weak binding forces in the nucleus of an atom. And all of those have to be incredibly tightly constrained in order for a universe to exist where there are stars and planets and life to be possible. That if you vary some of these constants by a tiny amount, the universe isn't even possible as we know it. Well, people don't realize that the constancy of decay rates is critically linked to that fine-tuning argument. In other words, the decay rate is dependent on those same constants. And the only way that decay rates could have widely varied in the past is if those physical constants varied widely in the past, which would mean that they don't have to be so tightly constrained. Said another way, you cannot logically hold or argue for the fine-tuning argument and for radioactive decay rates to have been much faster in the past. Those are mutually exclusive. All right, that was a little bit of a bunny trail. So we're going to revisit these supposed assumptions and how we would go about testing them. Now, if you were sitting in one of our classes on radiometric dating or actual geoscientists, we would actually describe some of the quantitative methods that are very sophisticated for actually determining things like how much daughter product might have been present in a sample at the start. And they're very rigorous methods. But instead, we want to just give you an example, a really cool example of how just overall, just the accuracy of radiometric dates can be tested. What can give us confidence that radioactive decay rates have been constant in the past and that our methods do actually yield realistic and accurate dates? We are going to do something similar that we did in the previous example, where we're going to combine two different methods or two different observations in order to demonstrate the accuracy of radiometric dating. So to introduce this, we're going to be talking a little bit about plate tectonics and island formation in the Pacific Ocean. So Ken, for our non-scientist listeners here, tell us a little bit about plate tectonics, the Pacific Ocean, and these island chains that are out there in the Pacific Ocean.
Well, thank you. This is the right timing. I was just giving a lecture about that this morning to all Roberts University students, so I could think about it. So you all know about the Big Island of Hawaii, that it has a volcano that's been active recently. And in fact, it's one of the volcanoes around the world that's most active. And our understanding of that volcanic activity is that over the millions of years, there has been a hot spot down underneath where the Big Island is now that is generating liquid lava that comes up through a plume and through the Pacific Ocean crust, and it comes out first on the seabed, and then it builds an island. It builds a volcano that gets higher and higher and higher, and eventually that volcanic activity comes up above the sea surface, and then it becomes an island, and it's that type of volcanic activity that has formed all the Hawaiian islands. Now, as you know, they are spread apart over five major islands that are to the northwest of the Big Island. So they go from Hawaii and then Maui and Oahu and Kauai up toward the northwestern end of the major islands. And so we see the evidence that the plate of that Pacific Ocean has been moving to generate those different islands. And not only has it been doing that for those islands, but it's been active a much longer part of the time so that the string of islands goes up to the northwest at about 1,000 miles, and then 1,000 miles to the northwest. There's a bend in this chain of submarine mountains, which are called the Emperor's Seamounts. And so that whole chain goes the whole way up to the Aleutian Islands. So think of a sheet of paper, and you hold it over a candle and slowly move the sheet of paper over that candle, and then you would get burn marks on the candle that are successive because the candle, or because the sheet of paper has come over the top of that candle. So that's the kind of thing that we have in this long chain that in total works out to about 3,700 miles. And something like 30 to 40 of those islands have had radiometric dating methods done. And the timing of those at the upper end turn out to be about 80 million years ago. So we have, starting with the Big Island, we have like 400,000 years. The several Hawaiian islands that we have habitation on, those go up to about 5 million years. And then successively, it goes eventually to about 80 up along the Aleutian Islands.
Yeah. So just summarizing a little bit, we've got the Pacific plate that, you know, we've got this evidence that it has been moving to the west, and prior to that, a bit to the northwest, where you've got this hot spot that just pokes up, and as the plate's moving over the top of it, so that you've got this long, very linear set of islands and underwater seamounts. And just in case you're wondering, like, why are those older ones underwater? Some of them are underwater. Part of that is that at the hot spot, the crust is heated, and so it's expanded. And as the plate moves and cools, that crust contracts, and those things that might have been above sea level at one time now are below sea level, some of them more than 1,000 feet below sea level. All right, so we have radiometric dates for many of these islands and seamounts, and we have distances between them. So if we were to measure the distance between two islands, and we then take the radiometric dates and we subtract one from the other to get, according to the radiometric dates, the amount of time between one island forming and the next, and we simply divide those, right, where we've got a distance over time, that gives us a speed, right, so like miles per hour, where given the rate that these are traveling, more like inches per year. Well, geologists don't necessarily expect or insist on the plate moving at the same speed all the time. Geologists are very open to the possibility that plate velocities were considerably slower, considerably faster in the past. But if you look at multiple islands and seamounts and look at the distance between them, look at the difference in the radiometric dates, calculate a speed, then it turns out to be fairly consistent that it's like in the range of like 2.5 to 3.5 inches per year. So a little bit faster than your fingernails grow. Now, here is the really cool part. We can actually measure plate movement and speed in real time. Same system that you use in your cell phones, that when you're in your car, that your cell phone could actually tell you how fast you're driving on the highway or how fast one of your kids is driving, by bouncing a signal off a satellite, where that's going to record how far you traveled and how much time it took to travel that distance. It's going to divide those and get a speed. Well, we have stations on a bunch of places around the planet, on continents, and on a couple of the Hawaiian Islands, where they're bouncing signals off of satellites and are able to measure the speed of the plate movement as we speak. Now, plate movement and radioactive decay have nothing to do with each other. Nothing. So if radioactive decay rates have been variable in the past, or for whatever reason we just can't trust radiometric dating, they give wrong answers, then we have no reason to expect that the speed based on radiometric dating would be anywhere in the same league or ballpark as what we measure in real time today. All right, so recall what I said. Based on radiometric dating and distance between islands, we've got about 2.5 to 3.5 inches per year. The Pacific plate at Hawaii, as we speak, is moving at just over 3 inches per year. It doesn't get much better than that for being able to test and verify that these supposed assumptions we've been making are actually true. God actually gave us some really cool tools to be able to look back into the unobserved past and to figure out what God did. Pretty amazing. All right, any last thoughts, Ken?
Privilege of being able to think God's thoughts after him in the privileges that he has given us to make these kinds of investigations and discoveries.
If you are interested in going a little bit deeper on this, there are a couple books. One is Friend of Science, Friend of Faith, which is a book that I wrote. And there is another book that has 11 authors that Ken and I were both contributors to. I served as a text editor, which is this Grand Canyon Monument to an Ancient Earth. If you join us next episode, I'm going to have another guest who's another friend and also another co-author on the Grand Canyon book, Joel Duff, who's a biologist, where we'll start to look at what is the evidence for adapting life via evolution. Hope to see you there.